This is the December 1 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois, Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing from Champaign, Illinois, and Kurt Kimmel of AgMarket.net out of Normal, Illinois. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G.org, or seek us out in your favorite podcast application. Scott Irwin, agricultural economist, now joins us from the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign to talk about the RVOs, Renewable Volumes Obligations, under the RFS proposal that U.S. EPA put out on Thursday. Thank you for taking some time with us, Scott. First, can you explain what the difference this year is with the RVO set as compared to previous years?
Previous years were under, well, we had a starting point of a table of targeted volumes that were written directly into the statute for the mandate levels. Those ended with the 2022 calendar year. So this is the first set of RVOs under what's known as the big reset, where the EPA had much more discretion about setting the volumes because there weren't specific targets now that they had to meet. There were only broad criteria in the law about how to set the RVO volumes post-2022, and this is the first one.
And it's just proof, I think, as you tweeted earlier today, that this law does not sunset?
And that is a very important point that a lot of people have misunderstood. There is no sunset until the U.S. Congress amends, repeals the RFS, and the president signs off on that. We will have annual RVOs under the RFS forever.
And this one more question for you as it related to this, and it's about ethanol usage, which is not mandated, but generally for corn. How does this differ from previous year? Because it's not just 1 year this time around, it's 3 years, and it also looks back.
Correct. So, you know, it's a three-year set of RVOs to give the biofuels industry and obligated parties in the energy industry some sense of, over a multi-year horizon, what the RVOs are going to be. And then the look back is, we're still dealing with the what is called vacate and remand in 2017 of, I believe it was the 2016 RVO, it was 2015, I don't remember the specific year, where there was a cut of 500 million gallons in the conventional, and the court said you got to put it back in. So here we are all these years later, and we're going to add 250 million a year to, I think, 23 and 24, or it's 24 and 25. I can't remember which 2 years, to finally make up for those illegally waived gallons way back in the past.
Oh, so that's why there's a 15 billion gallon for 2023, but 15.25 for 24 and 15.25 billion gallon obligation for 2025 then.
That's right. So they did it in the back 2 years. That's exactly what it is. They split it across 2 years. And so you're making up the illegally waived gallons based on the 2017 court decision. And so the biodiesel, or the, excuse me, the ethanol industry can thank one Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh for those gallons, because he's the one that gave them to him.
Kurt, do you have a question?
Yeah. Today, January soybean oil's lock limit down is 105,000 contracts for sale at most of the morning there, and there's only 133,000 open interest there. So, Scott, what would you see in here? What was the bearish news here? We kind of viewed it as not that negative, but the market interpreted it as negative. What are we missing here, you think?
Well, I think it's all a matter of perspective. Apparently, the market has been baking in huge demand for renewable diesel, kind of a build it and they will come mentality. And they thought basically that all of these massive expansion plans for renewable diesel apparently would be recognized in the RVO numbers starting in 2023 and then 24 and 25, that you know, you'd have to have big increases in the advanced biofuel and biomass-based diesel RVOs to justify the expansion in RD and the lofty veg oil values. My own personal view is, wow, I've been standing on a different planet apparently than everybody else, because that never made sense to me. And I've never thought that that was going to happen. And I take a completely different view on these RVOs than what apparently was baked into the markets.
Dave, you want to follow up?
Yeah, Dr. Well, those are kind of a great perspective. And I guess this is, you know, I think very confusing to the average producer, to the farmers out here. You got four classes of RINs already, and now it appears that maybe you're going to add in a fifth with this E-RIN value. And I think today is a good example of kind of that stroke of a pen risk that we face, you know, from a marketing and risk management perspective across the entire agricultural space, not just the producer side of the ag complex. But we're in a situation where I think, you know, like you said, very different viewpoints between what these, you know, some of the largest ABCD merchants in the world were talking about and putting these assets and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars towards these plans, particularly in the north and northwestern part of the belt, versus what I think was expected by some other folks. We had a big adjustment to that going forward. And now we have the introduction, you know, into the renewable fuel space of this E-RIN, where it appears that they're proposing that electrical vehicle manufacturers, so Tesla essentially, are going to be allowed to generate a credit or an E-RIN under this new program, and that the vehicle manufacturer can share that credit with the biogas or electricity producer that uses that biogas to charge the car. And so I guess I'm very curious as to what you think of this in terms of the political landscape and how it introduces, you know, is this just a big promotion for electric vehicles, or is this something that we're missing here, and how the two of these seemingly kind of opposite, you know, players get along or merge together, if you will?
Right. Well, I think this continues what I call the fancy footwork of the EPA of expanding of what we mean by a biomass-based fuel, and that it doesn't really need to be liquid. That really, that horse left the barn when they first allowed biogas from landfills to qualify as a pathway under the EPA for a D3 cellulosic RIN. My understanding that was based on the idea that the lignin in paper was generating the methane in landfills. And so that's what started it, and that started taking off. And now it is important to recommend, you know, to keep this all in perspective in terms of the E-RINs. There's a basic constraint on the ability to generate E-RINs based on the ability to generate biogas. And right now that's fundamentally from dairy methane capture and landfills, because, you know, that's the base. You have to prove that your pathway starts with biogas, and then that the biogas is burnt in to produce electricity, and then somehow that gets an offset through some formula in use in electrical EVs. And so that's how you start with biogas, you know, being generated ultimately to produce this new E-RIN. And I have to read about it, and I don't know all, you know, that's my very limited knowledge. But it's not like every mile driven with an EV is going to be eligible to generate an E-RIN. No, this is all constrained by how much biogas can be produced. And so that's going to be an important number going forward in understanding compliance with the RFS going forward is, okay, what really is the size of that ability to generate that biogas. I mean, they've got in the standards a very aggressive target for under cellulosic biofuels for that pathway. I don't know how realistic that is, but certainly going to need to figure it out.
Do either of you have more questions?
Yeah, I do. So if I buy an electric car and charge with bio, am I eligible for carbon credits then?
You mean under the LCFS? The biogas is already generating credits, massive credits, under the LCFS already. And but the big picture on this is, I wanted to put in the point why my take is so apparently different from everyone else, is that I start from what I call the policy lean of the Biden administration when they put out the final rulemaking for 2020, 21, and 22, which was not that long ago, where they actually went back and revised downward the final rulemaking for 2020 well after the fact, which I still regard as a blatantly illegal rulemaking. And apparently, you know, nobody challenged them on this, proved the rule that apparently under COVID, anything could be justified legally. But that was a very negative policy lean, how the Biden administration chose to implement the 20 through 22 RVOs, in my opinion, and combined with the long-standing, you know, public statements of the energy industry, the crude oil refining industry, that they really wanted to use the big reset post-2022 to give the RFS a major haircut, that I'm surprised that the RVOs released today are as positive as they are. I think it's a real victory that the RVOs, you know, 15 billion gallons for the conventional plus the remand 500 million gallons. I'm looking at that going, man, that could have been a lot worse based on recent history. Now, I recognize that's not what was baked into the market, particularly the veg oil market, obviously, after the price move today. But this is an example where I don't know, you know, what those folks were smoking if they really thought all those RD plants were going to get built and use that much soybean oil. I never bought into that scenario.
Finally, this is just a proposal. It will take some commentary. What's the forward path on the proposal?
Well, it's just a standard proposal. I think it's 60 days for comments. I'd have to double check on that. And so the EPA will hold some hearings like they always do. They'll probably get a zillion comments, and there'll be relatively minor adjustments and fiddling with the numbers here and there. But I would be very surprised if the these headline numbers change very much.
Scott Irwin, of course, is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois. Now let's turn to the reaction in Chicago that happened after the release, I think happened after the release of these figures from U.S. EPA related to the RFS and renewable volume obligations. One other item that was taking place all at once was rainfall that was coming into the drought-stricken areas of Argentina. Kurt, which one of those two played a larger role today, do you suppose?
I think both of those, plus the technical picture. When you look at the soybean chart in general there, we came up and kind of a bull trap. We started to break out to the upside there and failed to follow through. Then with the bio news and a better chance of some rain, that was the fundamental catalyst to turn everybody to the negative side in a hurry. But it started yesterday with the meal oil spread. They were buying the meal and selling the oil pretty big. And of course, today it was just huge from the standpoint that the January soybean oil closed down 450, the limit, and the meal was up 350, 380 there. So there's some majoring shuffling around. And I think it was just a combination of all those above there. And then two, the market is kind of in a holiday trading mode here. There's just not a whole lot of volume or interest other than today with a massive sell type of program kicking in here from mid-morning on.
Dave, I know this is probably way too early to call this because we haven't seen overnight or trade on Friday, but is this a bellwether moment for the marketplace?
Well, Todd, I think you want to look at it in the context of the answer. The short answer is probably yes. And I think it's more a situation of it's not necessarily the gravity or the event of just this one, you know, announcement that we had today. I think it's more of the straw that broke the camel's back in a situation where we know we've got, you know, an improving forecast in Argentina now. We've got a very big, you know, record-type crop brewing in South America, although it's a little ways before we land that. And we've been stuck in a somewhat of a trading range where beans of late anyway, and then the soy complex, I should say, of late anyway, has been up towards the top of that range. And we're getting into the time of the year where we go into the end of the year and the market's looking for fresh perspective and trading on low volume. So I think it could set a stage for what to be a little bit of a weaker trend going forward. When you look at our export pace and the window of those new export, you know, potential closing with China in particular between now and let's say, you know, the end of the year, well, we're not going to get a lot more exports under our belt. We can probably meet the USDA mandate, USDA projection here, but we're not going to do a lot better than that in terms of creating additional demand based on the pricing scenarios that are out there. When we look at the other big component on the soybean side, in terms of where we're at with domestic crush, this, you know, part of that crush had been, it's still very profitable. The crush margins didn't take a huge hit today with the way things went, but certainly it has the effect of eroding that potential for crush margin down the road as these bean oil inventories have been building and our exports, you know, have been negative or we've seen cancellations in bean oil over the last couple of weeks. So the demand foundation that was under beans that was helping it get to and stay at these levels, I think, is starting to crumble just a little bit, Todd. It'll probably take place in a kind of two steps down, one step back type of a fashion rather than, you know, straight down like we saw today. But I think it's definitely going to be knocking out one of the bullish, you know, kind of tenets or columns that we've had underneath the market here for a while in this way complex.
Kurt, you've mentioned the technical side of this picture. That can give you a roadmap. On Thursday afternoon, what did it really look like and are there objectives?
Well, we're kind of back. We're still caught in the middle of this trading range we've been in for the whole month of November here. But if you look at the weekly price action, you take yesterday's high and where we are here, we're in danger of recording a weekly price reversal to the downside. Momentum and technical indicators have kind of rolled over in through here. So we're kind of in a situation here where this market could struggle. The big picture was to be kind of firm going into middle of December here. But if we don't finish out the week here in a strong mode, then we're in danger of probably seeing some pretty good selling start to take place on dead cat bounces.
Well, what should farmers do? And I'll ask both of you that. But Dave, why don't you start for me?
Well, Todd, I think, yeah, you know, this today is a great example of this kind of uncertainty that we're facing and things that are, you know, today's move was somewhat fundamental to the grain complex, but totally outside the control of the farmer. And you know, what an EPA mandate does to a trading sentiment and different things. And there's a lot going on around the world currently, a lot of things that we can't account for, from a war in Russia to what's going on with China and their fight of COVID and what it might do to their demand profile, to the, you know, the global banks fighting inflation and what that might mean for recession. And overall, with all that in play here, we're looking at levels today, whether it's old crop or new crop, for producers that are still fairly profitable here. And I think, you know, with the uncertainty that's out here and with a balance sheet that looks to me anyway to be, I think the risk in corn is that carry out grows. I think the risk in beans is starting to lean that way as well. And certainly it doesn't get a lot tighter, assuming that the weather in South America, you know, continues to perform, you know, relatively well. I think that starts to lean me to the point where I want to be advancing sales and getting a little bit more aggressive and certainly becoming a marketer on rallies here going forward and taking that risk off the table. If we get into a situation, whether it's after the first of the year in South America or further down the road in the spring in the U.S. where weather, you know, looks to become a risk, you know, that's what options and that's what, you know, hedging and paper tools are available for. But right now there's a margin on the table. I think there's a lot of uncertainty out there, and I think you want to move a little bit more of that risk off the table and into your pocket here.
Yeah, Dave, I think you pretty well hit the nail on the head there. I've turned more cautious in through here. I agree with what Dave said there. I think you got to maybe sell and defend or you know, do some price structures here where you got a price floor. There's not a whole lot of grain for sale right now, but after the first year, I think guys are going to be a little bit more willing sellers. And then as mentioned here, if this weather cooperates in the Southern Hemisphere or this political situation deteriorates a little bit more, I think the risk is to the downside, not to the upside for right now. Far as upside goes, it's probably going to be later on, maybe early in the growing season. But for right now, I think you got to be a defensive player and trade the market and market accordingly.
Does the market surprise you given what the reaction, other than the soybean oil, which we'll see how that rolls out, I guess, and its impact on soybeans. But the reaction, generally speaking, in CGA applauding the RVOs from USDA, Scott Irwin saying, hey, this was way better than we expected. 15 billion gallons for the 2023 growing season or 2023 calendar year, 15 and a quarter for both the 24 and 25 years. Rail strike appears that it has been averted. And while there is rainfall in Argentina, that crop's been under stress for a while. And it appears that China may be backing off of some of its COVID restrictions. That all sounds positive as opposed to negative to me. Why is it that the marketplace is so concerned?
Yeah, Todd. So, I mean, I think the concern simply comes in the fact that we're, you know, the supply side of the balance sheet in the U.S. is now pretty well established. We'll have our final numbers that come out, not in the December report, but in the January report. But typically, you know, the trade is not expecting a lot of change to the supply side. When we look at the demand side, we're in a situation where, you know, particularly from a, an export standpoint where we have some trouble, the U.S. values, whether it's corn, beans, or even wheat, are well above and not competitive with some of the values that we see out of South America and the Black Sea going forward. And we're looking at a situation where a record crop is brewing in South America. You're talking about a bean crop in Brazil that could be a billion bushels larger than it was a year ago. You're talking about a corn crop that could be over 500 million bushels larger than it was a year ago. So I think it's the demand side of the equation. You know, we've gotten through harvest. The market was focused on supply and yield. We're now focusing on demand and looking forward into the new crop, into the new year and what's going to happen. And that demand profile is starting to look a little bit shaky. We've got the ethanol. I agree with you. I think we're lucky that we got the RVO, you know, conventional mandate that we did in a situation where gasoline demand is running 4.5% below where it was a year ago. We've got electric vehicles. We've got, you know, the things going on that are, you know, that are seismic shifts in the way the demand is going, gasoline is going to be used in the U.S. So we've got some issues to overcome there. And, you know, the market to me has held together relatively well to this point and probably carried a little bit of a risk premium. And I think we're seeing that start to work its way out here as we look at some of these crops and what our competitive situation looks like going forward.
Longer term, I think there's some optimism. I mean, this whole thing we saw here, I think it's constructive when you look forward in through here. You've got major commercials building major, huge crushing plants, and I don't think they're going to do that and not have a future in front of us. It's just short term in through here is kind of the concern. I believe the end users getting fairly well booked up to where they want to be. They got caught here late summer not having some inventory. The Western basis remains strong. Just they're caught, but I believe they're getting to where they want to be in through here. So we're kind of in a situation where we could, you know, probably test the lower end of the range. Is it all over? No, but it feels like the risk is to the downside here as the calendar turns 2023.
How important, Kurt, is it that the ABCDs of the grain industry are involved with the oil industry on the development of these renewable diesel and crush plants?
Well, it needs to be a working partnership. I think everybody needs to kind of work together on it. I believe one can benefit. If you try to tackle it on your own, it's going to be an issue. The electric vehicle, I was kind of surprised or didn't know that, you know, you're going to use bio to charge your your electric, because electric long term is the way to go. And that is, you know, the risk of some domestic demand long term. So as long as the ag side and the energy side can work together, I think that's just huge.
Yeah, so there is a new avenue for greenhouse gas development of the RINs through the e-RIN, I suppose. Any other things that we ought to talk about? We haven't really discussed the corn market very much. Can you take that up to some extent for me, please, Dave?
Yeah, Todd, I think when we look at the corn complex here, a couple things going on. I mean, you know, as we talked earlier in the show, we're waiting for the USDA to issue the final, you know, yield and production results for this year. We'll get that in January coming up here. But as we look forward here, our corn export performance is pretty woeful right now. We're running, you know, well below where we were a year ago. We're running well below, you know, what's needed to get to the USDA's annual projection and target. We're in a situation where if we look right now, Ukrainian corn is offered, last I looked this morning, around $265 a metric ton. The U.S. is $315. Brazil is $288. And, you know, we need to find a way to compete in that export market. And right now, it's looking a little bit tough for us here. You know, there's a lot of things that could change there. We could see the Black Sea grain corridor reclose. We could have a weather market develop in Brazil. There are a number of things that could change that going forward, but we have a carryout situation that is supportive of, as Kurt indicated, of some prices here that are, you know, that are historically high, but maybe not quite as high as where we sit right now. If you look at the ethanol sector, we've seen a very, you know, sharp build in ethanol stocks here over the last 2 weeks. I think it's 7.5% just in the last 2 weeks. We're seeing producer margins come under a little bit of pressure here, and that just ties back to like I said, gasoline demand here is running about 4.5%. below where it was a year ago at this time. And in doing so, you know, we're at a blend rate where unless we can get the E15 thing to catch on and go forward, we're not going to be able to blend a lot more conventional biofuel here. So the demand drivers for corn right now, I think, are where we're struggling. And the market is having a little bit of a tough time seeing how those improve and get stronger and get better and shrink that carry out as opposed to that carry out maybe moving back the other way. So I think there's some cautious optimism out here and a lot of things that can always change. But for right now, the market, you know, as we've talked about, just feeling a little bit reluctant here to try and find an excuse to go higher. And we're seeing some liquidation because of that.
Just one more thing to add to that, though, is on the domestic demand is feed demand. What we're seeing is some of the packer-owned feeders are feeding to heavier weights, but these other guys are starting to move this pork particularly to lighter weights. And what I mean by that is I think we're starting to cut into some profitability on the meat side of the equation here. So feed demand might slip just a little bit. Then also, too, in order to straighten the economy, we have to have unemployment take place, and that unemployment and hiring starting to show up here. And if we continue to move down this recessionary concern, that could ding some demand too, Todd.
Well, that was my next question related to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's comments earlier in the week that he expects inflation to continue, but also he expects that the Fed will take off the gas a bit in December and not raise rates as high as they have in the past. He didn't say they wouldn't raise rates, just that they'd begin to slow that process down. How much of an impact does that have on the marketplace, do you think, Dave?
Well, I think it's the sentiment is the biggest part, Tom. We've got a lot of liquidity in this market that has been on the sideline or effectively sidelined. We've had rates coming up. We've now got some competition between does money go strictly into equities or does it go back into a fixed income investment? And with some of those fixed incomes now at 4.5%, 5%, you know, that battle is on just a little bit. So any signs of what I'll call the long-awaited pivot from the Fed, pivoting away from this aggressive interest rate hike, is going to be welcomed by the equity market, by the markets in general. And I think it helps open the door to money coming back into the market in a number of different sectors, including commodities. And, you know, having said that, I think we're probably, you know, still expecting a 50-point basis hike when we get to the December 14th meeting, and probably at least another 25-point hike thereafter to follow. When I look at, you know, the U.S. CPI and the PPI numbers compared to where we have the Fed funds rate and the inflation values versus where interest rates are at, I guess I'm a little perplexed by what Powell said looks to me like we still have a pretty good gap to close. So I don't know that I would bet the under on that situation just yet, but hopefully the end of the road is not too far, you know, in the distant future in terms of these rate hikes and what they mean, you know, to interest rates. We've seen farm, you know, operating loans here, you know, coming back 6.5%, 7%, and 7.5% for 2023. Definitely going to be a different year in terms of what you're paying to borrow money here to operate as a farmer.
Time-wise, they're looking for February, maybe this all to run its course. And like Dave hinted on there, we're probably due for another, you know, point and a quarter up there. But the key is this operating loans, and that's going to be huge. Right now, guys have cash to work with here over the near term. But as soon as they run out of cash and have to borrow money, it's going to be an eye-awakening experience.
We'll get a final word from each of you now. Kurt, please, your final word.
No, it's a dynamic marketplace. When you're watching the front door, something comes in the back door. But I think we got to stay awake here as we go into the spring. I believe with these higher input costs going into 2023, we got to be shrewd marketers and have some type of price floor established as we start to enter the growing season.
And Dave Chatterton.
Yeah, Kurt, I'm with you there 100%. I think, you know, maybe we'll put it in the simplistic terms that we can. And I think if you go back and you study commodity markets, as long as, you know, the three of us have talked about them and looked at them, we know that they have a cyclical nature to them. But, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that profitability at the farm level also is cyclical along with those commodity prices. Been in a heck of a heater here. We had a record here in 2022 for most producers here in terms of revenue and yield and what that meant to profitability at the farm level. I think when we look ahead into next year, you have to be, viewing that with a little bit of a different viewpoint going forward as interest rates go up, as inputs go up, as we have some reason to maybe see commodity prices come under just a little bit of a pressure. So it's a little bit more of a defensive tone here going forward. And I think it's time to be, you know, not time to be sitting on your laurels here and waiting. I think it's time to be taking action in terms of being able to manage your profitability and taking some risk off the table.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like online at WILLAG.org or search it out in your favorite podcast application. We'd like to thank our panelists this week, including Kurt Kimmel of AgMarket.net out of Normal, Illinois, Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, Illinois, and Scott Irwin, agricultural economist at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois. I'm U of I Extensions. Todd Gleason.